This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 124th show in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm super pleased to have with me today Lance Cottrell. Hi, Lance.
Hey, Gary. How's it going?
Good. Dr. Lance Cottrell is chief scientist at Intrepid, where he works on the Passages product. Lance founded Anonymizer, Inc. in 1995 and took it to exit in 2008. He's been at the cutting edge of internet privacy, anonymity, and security for over 20 years. Lance is also active with startups and is on the board of the North Bay Angels and a mentor for SoCo Nexus Sprout. Lance has a BA in physics from UC Santa Cruz and an MA and PhD in physics from UC San Diego. He lives in Sonoma County. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, and almost a PhD in physics. I actually started my company with the idea of finishing the PhD in my spare time, so I have most of the thesis
wrong.
In a box.
You got an ABD, huh?
I'm ABD, exactly.
Okay, well, we'll take that back. So you founded Anonymizer, Inc. in November 1995 when I was just getting started in computer security myself. Why did you found it?
Yeah, I really got started because of the whole second crypto wars. So the first crypto wars was a little too early for me, but when the Clipper chip came along, I was active on the internet because physicists were the people who really had access to the internet. I had a Sun Spark station on my desk directly connected to the backbone.
Yep.
And I got interested in these privacy and security issues. And so I joined the cypherpunks and started building and operating internet privacy tools. I wrote an anonymous remailer called Mixmaster.
Yep.
And that sort of got really exciting to me, rather more exciting than my thesis was.
And what I realized, did your thesis advisor say about that?
Well, he was a little disappointed, but it's hard to hold someone back when their passion is really pulling them. And, you know, there were 10 people in the world who really cared about the outcome of my thesis. And frankly, I'd already told all of them what the answer was. Whereas, you know, this, I was getting tens of thousands of people using the software I was writing. And, you know, I was excited about the issue. And I realized that the open source tools I was building were never going to be usable by the public.
You know, right.
The cypherpunk tools, the first instruction was always, you know, run this makefile on your Linux command line.
Exactly.
Which sort of ruled my mother out.
Your mother should have been geekier, Lance.
Yeah, well, my father could have managed it.
So what was the biggest technical challenge that faced the Anonymizer work?
You know, a lot of the challenges that we ran into were more on the legal side than the technical side early on.
Mm-hmm.
The first generation of Anonymizer was simply a web proxy which stripped out all the identifiers. And so that was pretty straightforward to remove, you know, cookies and hide the IP address and all that kind of stuff. The evolution of the protocols is what really started to kill us, where you began to get JavaScript and active content, and that made the filtering almost impossible. You almost had sort of a Turing termination problem where you could not prove that you'd successfully removed all of the content.
Yeah,
and that's when we started moving over to VPNs.
That was right at the time when Felton and I were writing about Java security, and we coined the term malicious mobile code, which was causing that problem, I suppose.
For sure. Well, I mean, it didn't even have to be malicious. I remember we ran into this issue where it turned out that I think it was people.com. The entire website HTML was written line at a time in JavaScript print statements.
Right. Interesting.
For who knows why, but, you know, just absolute brain damage of you know, meta leveling through some sort of an interpreter to try to understand what it was doing.
And that was back when JavaScript was whatever the interpreter takes today.
Yeah, right. I mean, this was simple JavaScript compared to what you see now.
Yeah. So what are your philosophical musings about anonymity and security and their interaction, given your 20-year involvement in all this stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I think anonymity is an interesting case. You often see a lot of people who feel like, you know, there may be a place for anonymity, but fundamentally the world should be identified. I kind of take the opposite tack, which is, you know, that which is, you know, does not have to be identified should probably support anonymity. Mm-hmm. Although in many cases, a lot of the things that people attribute to anonymity, they say people are cruel on the internet because they're anonymous. I think it has more to do with the fact that there's not an effective reputation mechanism, and it's not a face-to-face, right? It's a distant thing. You don't see the person flinch when you say something.
Right.
And I mean, I think if you look at Facebook and the harassment that takes place there, largely in true name, you know, you'll see that the anonymity is not probably the magic problem.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, sometimes you need anonymity for some transactions too, and sometimes you don't. But it seems to me the case that, generally speaking, security can be the enemy of anonymity when you take a naive approach to security.
Exactly. And I think a lot of people have taken sort of identity and authentication and conflated them, and they don't necessarily have to be conflated.
Right.
Yeah. What I care about if I'm exchanging an ongoing dialogue with someone is generally that I'm talking to the same person, not necessarily that I know that was the name on their birth certificate.
Right.
And of course, we've seen that, you know, blow up in Facebook's face when they're trying to deal with like transgender people who want to use some other name.
That's right. It's crazy wrinkles. But, you know, all those systems are ripe for abuse in a sense that you can create an identity and then fold it when it gets to be a pain and create a new identity and just keep hopping along.
I think that's actually a really interesting case because we do a terrible job of managing reputation online. That is, the difference between a Facebook account that was created yesterday and a Facebook account that's been, you know, robustly operated for years mm-hmm. in a, you know, upstanding way, it's not easy to tell the difference.
Right.
And so it enables that kind of hopping. I think that's less a problem of identification than it is of how do you manage a system to allow you to build reputation. And this is an idea that has been discussed, you know, heavily for years in science fiction. Werner Vinge talked about kind of reputation and identity, you know, back in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. Ender's Game has a robust discussion of how you would take pseudonymous identities and build them up. But yet somehow we've never actually bothered to build any of those ideas into the social networks that we've created.
Right.
And I think that's a failure of imagination rather than of, you know, impossible security problems.
Right. Yeah, that's probably true. We've also made, you know, some interesting, I guess, forward progress in anonymity and privacy. I'm interested to know what you think about the Tor network.
You know, the Tor network's a really interesting case, and they're almost as old as my systems, and they took a radically different tack. Right? Their idea is, how do you not have to trust any central authority? Right? They're sort of radically opposed to investing anyone with the keys to the kingdom, which I can respect. But the problem is that ends up, at least as they've implemented it, any volunteer then can become part of the network, and you're then vulnerable to a set of attacks by any of those volunteers.
Exactly. Well, that's what the FBI in some sense did, you know, looking at the exit node stuff.
Exactly. And you have to assume that some large fraction of exit nodes are run by people who do not have your best interests at heart, by whatever definition you want to choose for that.
Right.
Because, in fact, it's kind of surprising that there are as many legitimate altruistic people running these nodes as there are, because there's a huge amount of incentive for other groups to be running lots and lots of these things.
I think recently everybody believes that's what's happened.
Yeah. I mean, and I think that's probably a fair assumption. You know, if I was running an intelligence service, I would certainly own a whole lot of Tor nodes just to spy on them. Yeah.
Yeah. So Thomas Ridd, he wrote a great paper on Tor and the dark web. So there are some obviously unseemly aspects of all human societies, and the dark web is one of those. What's your reaction to that kind of stuff that shows up in these anonymizing systems?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting problem that you get these black markets taking place. I mean, at some level, I think a lot of the issues that we get upset about on the internet are really just recapitulating the same things that happen in the real world. But when you put the words "on the internet" at the end of it, everyone gets sort of disproportionately excited about it.
I think that's true. But if you look at the newspaper coverage from the 1800s, there used to be telephone murders, you know, where the telephone played a role in a murder. And so that was news. So maybe it's just that.
Well, I mean, I think that's certainly part of it. And you know, I remember people would talk about my anonymity products and say, how can you ethically allow people to send anonymous email? And back then I would say, well, you know, on most street corners, there are these blue anonymous communication boxes.
Yeah, right. Well, but they're not really anonymous. I mean, you know, the Postal Service actually scans all those addresses and keeps them in a giant database.
Sure, but you don't have to put a return address on it, and you can lie about it, and it's easy to drive across town. You know, yeah. They're pretty robust for ransom notes and things like that. You know, and of course, there's classified ads in the newspaper that have been used forever that you can place quite anonymously, and you know, number stations and all of these other things, which have, again, been recapitulated on the internet. You know, there's actually, if you remember Usenet groups, there's a group called alt.anonymous.messages, which is largely filled with blocks of ciphertext and nothing else.
I actually used NN because I liked the idea of no news is good news back in those days.
Yeah.
But that was a long time ago. Let's talk about attribution, which is sort of related. You know, it's kind of the counter of this problem. So when you're trying to do attribution, where are we these days? Can we do it?
Yeah, I tend to think that and you see these reports that say, you know, we know that this hack was caused by this group with this sort of attribution. And my personal feeling is that's really pretty weak.
Right.
You know, unless there's some really unusual zero-day exploit that has some code fragments that you're confident hasn't been reused. But these things, you know, as soon as they get out there, they start getting repurposed. And false flagging is so easy.
Absolutely. You know, like the most obvious way to defeat that kind of attribution.
Exactly. You know, and if you know people are going to suspect, say, the Russians for a certain activity, if you false flag as Russia, you've probably stopped the investigation right there because people found what they expected to find, and they're not going to dig much deeper. And, you know, the anonymity tools are easily robust enough, I think, to, in almost all cases, prevent any technical traceback.
Right.
So now you're looking into more subtle things like language analysis, which is surprisingly powerful and effective.
Yeah.
We built a tool for that to recognize authors and do author identification in our company, just as a little side project. And I had a lot of fun because back on the Cypherpunk mailing list, I had maintained over a couple of years a pseudonymous identity in addition to my true name activity.
Yeah.
And so I challenged my team to spot me.
And they made
some effort. Oh, yeah. They tagged me instantly.
You stuck out like a sore thumb.
I was kind of shocked. I was not thinking that they were going to be as successful as they were. But you know, he came back and said, you know, this is the top of the list. Like, oh, damn.
Was it that you always agreed with yourself in Flame Wars?
No, it was. In fact, I made a real point of not doing that. It was the way I write. It was looking at n-grams of my writing patterns.
Wow. Yeah.
And, you know, it turns out that's actually really difficult to hide.
So let's talk about two attribution issues in particular. The Sony hack. What do you think about the attribution job there?
You know, I don't have access to the raw data. You know, it seems an awfully convenient story, and it's a nice story, but it doesn't feel that compelling to me.
Right.
I certainly don't feel like that case has been made.
Right. And then I guess the one that's all in the news the last couple of days, the alleged DNC hack carried out by the Russians.
That seems even weaker to me. And it also, though, appears that there was more than one hack, probably. So that, you know, when a company's been pierced three or four times, it becomes even more difficult to understand the attribution of which of those players is doing which bit of damage that you're seeing coming out the other side.
Yeah, apparently the CrowdStrike guys said that those two groups had not even known the other people were in.
Yeah, I mean, that is the funny thing is that I think in general, many of these organizations, especially political organizations, are so weakly secured and internet security is just not even on their radar that, you know, the two or three hackers that we know of, it's probably exactly that. It's that we know of.
Right.
This may have an interesting effect, though, on that whole crypto security debate that, you know, the law enforcement guys have been saying, only bad guys have things to hide. We want to make sure that, you know, you don't have too much crypto. You don't have end-to-end. We want to make sure there's back doors. We want to make sure, you know, back to the Clipper chip, there's going to be some magic key that we're going to protect
right.
in some way. And as a victim of the OPM breach, I'm sort of somewhat suspicious of that.
Yeah, they're not very good at that protection part. The Chinese have my fingerprints too.
Yeah, exactly. So then when this starts hitting home that, I've been breached, all of my emails got hacked, we may start seeing some of the politicians saying, you know what, this crypto thing, that might have been a good thing if all of this was not available on the servers.
Yeah, of course, that's a little bit technically inaccurate, though, because it wasn't really, you know, the network that was being monitored. In these ATP situations, you have access to the entire machine and the file system. So, you know, it was the endpoint was actually hacked, which means that end-to-end encryption wouldn't really help.
No. And I have not looked through the dumps to see, is it just, you know, the data from a single endpoint, or were they able to actually pull, say, the entire mail server's contents down?
Yeah.
And yeah, you're right. That would certainly make a difference in the impact, and is much harder to defend against, right? If someone gets your endpoint, you're in a pretty difficult situation.
Yeah, they haven't dumped all the gigabytes of stuff they apparently have yet, from what I understand. But one interesting thing is it's clear that some of the files had actually been tampered with, at least in the first release. There were metadata tags in some of the files that were in Russian, for example. And in the second release, those had disappeared.
Huh. Yeah, I mean, these are becoming, and certainly Sony was, and this as well, these guys are learning how to make it orchestrated PR/propaganda events. You know, it's no longer everything drops at once, but it's metered out, it's dripped. And why not then start introducing new information? If you can do 90% of the damage with something that's made up, even if you get caught,
right?
You know, a lie goes around the world before the truth gets its pants on.
There you go. So
You know, it can be very effective for what, you know, and that you then start to get into a very conspiracy, you know, theory kind of mindset about this. But
yeah. So WikiLeaks, force for good, force for evil, relevant, irrelevant. What do you think?
You know, I think probably net, it has done a lot of good, but some of the picking and choosing is a little problematic. And I think now that it's been around for a while, we're starting to see these targeted hacks where people are leaking with a very strong agenda. And so that, you know, we may now start to see leak wars, right? Are a bunch of liberal hackers going to start trying to hack all of Trump's and the RNC's stuff so that they can counter leak and back and forth? It's
right.
It's an interesting problem. You know, it's similar to sort of the whole Snowden issue, which is I have a lot of problems with what he did, but I'm also kind of glad we know about some of the stuff that he revealed.
Yeah. And I guess if you have leaks that are being editorialized by the technology that's supposed to just publish them without comment, in some sense, that leads to the leak war situation. And then you'll have WikiLeaks and my real WikiLeaks and whatever. You know, they'll be competing sources of information, and all of a sudden they'll have an editorial stance.
Right. Well, and then you've got, like, you know, with some of the leaks about Afghanistan, they're saying, well, you should have censored, for example, the names of civilians in the country so that they don't get killed.
Yeah.
And that's certainly sort of a fairly moral argument. But once you start introducing the question of editing the content, then where, yeah, bright lines tend to be the only thing you can enforce. And this is what I realized back with Anonymizer, is we spent a lot of time thinking about what if someone bad uses our anonymity tools? You know, how do you enable the good purposes without the bad purposes? And the conclusion we finally came to is, if the data exists, I can be forced to hand it over for reasons that I would have a problem with.
Right.
And we ended up architecting the system from the ground up. So, you know, it was architected ignorance. We had no way of knowing it, so we could not be compelled to provide it.
Yeah, and in the days of national security letters, that's pretty essential.
Absolutely, right, because, you know, they can compel a lot of things. But so far, it looks like, and the Apple decision was one I watched really closely, it looks like they can't compel you to re-architect your systems to enable information gathering that they would like to have.
Right.
You know, absent some law, right? Because clearly CALEA did exactly that, right? It forces the phone companies to modify their phone switches to enable, you know, the following kinds of intercept. And so far, none of that's really applied to, you know, the kind of services I run. And that's a huge tension because, you know, once it's in there, of course, it's global. We think of it in terms of what about U.S. law enforcement? And, you know, you may hold whatever position you hold about U.S. law enforcement, but in general, you know, they're fairly upstanding. They do a good job. They're not evil. But that's certainly not true of law enforcement everywhere in the world. And these things have huge collateral damage effects in countries that are much less upstanding about their law enforcement and attention to the rule of law and so forth.
Yeah, an example of that from the WikiLeaks case is what's going on with some of the people that were outed in various WikiLeaks documents surrounding Turkey. In particular, lots of women that were activists had, you know, accidentally been outed, sideswiped by WikiLeaks. And it seems that, according to the people in Turkey at least, the government is using that information to round up people.
Right. Exactly what you would expect to happen is, you know, this data is valuable to someone and it was released with one purpose, but once it's out there, you have no control of the purpose to which it's put.
Right.
And I think that is one of the moral complications about WikiLeaks is how do you draw that line? And, you know, they've largely taken, I think, the bright line, we're going to release everything, but I don't think they've taken full moral responsibility for the implications of that.
Yeah. And the drip certainly calls into question, you know, this kind of moral purity idea.
Exactly, right. When you turn from being here's the data we have, to an orchestrated PR campaign that's carefully timed around political events, you know, we're going to drip this out during the Democratic convention. Well, that's not accidental timing, right?
Right. We'll be right back after this message. If you like what you're hearing on Silver Bullet, make sure to check out my other projects on GaryMcGraw.com. There you can find writings, videos, and even original music. So let's switch gears a little bit. You've been working on secure web browsing now for a few years. How does that stand? And then what impact does mobile security and geolocation have on your thinking about secure web browsing?
So we started thinking about browser security because we had fairly good solutions to securing most of the other paths into our own business. And we originally were looking at this internally. You know, you can sit and scan all the attachments, you can look at sources, email's pretty good, you can restrict and train people not to put thumb drives in their computers. But the web is one of those things that you have to touch. It can contain really any kind of content, and it's real time. You don't have time to run detonators and, you know, try to execute the code in a sandbox or something like that.
Right.
And browsers are gigantic and hairy beasts with bazillions of lines of code, so they're going to have enormous numbers of vulnerabilities. So that's where we focused, and we quickly realized that actually writing a browser that wasn't going to be full of holes was going to be impossible. So we focused on the virtualization and isolation approach, putting a conventional browser in a virtual machine, mm-hmm. hardening the heck out of that machine, and then making sure it can't talk to the local desktop, which works really well on the desktop. The mobile situation is much more complicated, especially because with Apple, they really lock down the kind of things you can do. And it's a catch-22. On the one hand, that hugely improves security. But on the other hand, it hugely limits the kind of security tools you can build.
Right. And let's talk about the implications of geolocation, too, when it comes to the mobile stuff. You know, you're basically putting a browser on a phone, and then it's got access to various other information that may not be coming from your PC all the time.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, you're right. We've all gotten really trained to carry around these location devices that are tracking us at all times, and God knows I've been giving enough to Nintendo and friends recently with catching all the Pokemon.
Are you just catching them all on your driveway?
That's right. Just, yeah, walking to and from the mailbox. No competition. But you're right. I mean, the amount of location information that we're giving out, and to huge numbers of people, right? So the phone company knows where you are. The phone manufacturer, Google, knows who you are. You know, each one of these other apps knows who you are. The websites are all requesting information. And a lot of the browsers will at least alert you and say, do you want to provide this information to this person at this time? But, you know, even laptops have geo information, because most of the high resolution geo information is actually coming from Wi-Fi locations.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So just looking at what Wi-Fi nodes are in sight, even if you're not logged into them, that provides very high accuracy information about your location.
Yeah. So, you know, assuming we sort of get a handle on the secure web browsing for boxes that are mostly stationary, bar laptops, then we have a much harder problem with the mobile devices, I think.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think the virtualization, and what we've done is inside the virtual machine, we VPN the traffic out to one of our nodes and then bounce it out. So the IP address is not associated with you. And, you know, we scrub out all the identifiers, because things like cookies and super cookies, you know, that are much harder to delete, provide really effective tracking. And then, you know, there's so many ways of tracking, like Panopticlick and the browser fingerprint, and now the Canvas fingerprinting, where they're actually fingerprinting the video hardware and firmware in your computer, which provides yet more bits of data. And virtualization helps with that, in that you can make sure that the fingerprints all look exactly the same.
Right.
And that's a pretty big win. Hmm. So that, you know, you're now identifiable as using a tool, but are indistinguishable from everyone else using the tool.
I guess that's good. You know, the crowd solution from way back when in the 90s that AT&T did required a crowd. You know,
yeah.
If you have a mixed network and there's only two people on it, it's not very powerful.
Exactly. I mean, that's the interesting thing about anonymity tools, is you have to have a large number of users. Your anonymity is entirely dependent on, you know, the size of that anonymity set at any given moment. And getting back to Tor, that's actually one of the problems they've got, is it's real time, which allows all sorts of other attacks, as opposed to, say, email, which is store and forward, which allows much better protection of identity, because you can't then watch, you know, the individual variations of each channel. I mean, they've done attacks on crypto where they were able to reconstruct voice communications by sniffing an encrypted link and just looking at the bandwidth variations.
Yeah, wow. Yep. So, you started way back with the Mixmaster remailer that you mentioned before. So the last thing I want to talk about is, have we made any progress with email privacy and security, you think?
You know, no. It's one of those things. Email security is terrible. The tools are still awkward to use. They don't integrate well with the clients. And, you know, S/MIME is built into everyone's email clients now, and almost no one uses it.
Yeah. Right?
And it still leaks metadata. It leaks the subject line. It leaks to and from and all the traffic. But it would be better than nothing, and yet still almost no one uses it.
Well, I had to re-up my cert Saturday, which I did, and I haven't gotten around to populating all of my devices with the new crypto yet, which I need to do. It's going to take me an hour to do them all.
Exactly, right? It's not easy, and you know, you take this seriously, but your average person, there's no way they're going to spend an hour working out how to export and import the certs to all of their different devices. It's this huge hairy mess. And I think it's going to have to be a provider-side support, where, like the web, right, SSL is built into every browser. And we know there's all kinds of problems with SSL, and there's weaknesses, and there's attacks, and there's issues with the certificate authorities. But it's still 1,000% better than unencrypted, you know, HTML.
Yeah.
And the same thing, I think, is true of the web, that we understand how to build things that are fairly secure and fairly anonymous, but what we're doing is, you know, a tenth of a percent of that. And so anything we can do would be a huge step forward.
Yeah, I guess one of the challenges is that, you know, the companies that are providing the free email services that everybody uses, I'm thinking, you know, Microsoft and Google and Yahoo, or Verizon, as the case may be. Those guys, the reason their service is free is because you're the product, you know. You can have targeted ads based on the content of your email. And if the mail is encrypted, that makes that much harder to do.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I think it's interesting that they don't even give an option to pay. And maybe they feel like it would send a bad message and give people a bad taste in their mouth. But I'm just hungry for many of these people for an option to say, can I give you, you know, $50 a year or whatever and stop reading what I'm doing and make everything encrypted and keep it secure and manage that. I mean, I suppose run my own mail server, but I have a fairly, you know yourself is the first rule. I know I'm not going to maintain that mail server at my house with the love and care and, you know, and patching and security that it deserves because I'm busy doing other things. That's not my job.
Right. Interesting. So let's talk about some of those other things that you do. What is the best batch of Pinot Noir that's ever come from your Sonoma grapes?
Well, I've only been making wine out of my own grapes now for 2 years. The 14s are in bottle. They're tasting pretty good. Uh-huh. But I'm learning what I'm doing. The 15s are tasting amazing, and I'll probably be bottling them in maybe a month. And the grapes outside my window have just gone through veraison, so they've just turned from green to red, and it looks like a pretty big harvest. So
cool.
I think the 2016 may be a good year and a reasonable quantity.
That's much better than running mail servers, Lance.
That's right. The grapes outside the window are a distraction from patching the server in the basement.
Cool. Well, thanks for your time today. It's been really interesting.
Thanks much. It was great talking to you, Gary.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Sigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. The May-June issue of IEEE S&P focuses on the economics of cybersecurity. It also features our interview with Jacob West, in which we discuss the IEEE Center for Secure Design. Check out the video we shot to celebrate episode 120 of Silver Bullet, 10 years of the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. You can find that on the net. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigil.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.